Our guest this week is a leading figure in the radio industry and what many of us in the business would call a great radio guy. That means he has talent, is successful, and is extremely likable as a person. He's the president of a multifaceted company called Benstown, a Southern California-based firm that he formed in 2008 with international radio producers Andrea Sonnemann and Oliver Klenk, both based in Stuttgart, Germany. Benstown originally specialized, and still does, in providing radio stations across the country with high-quality production elements and support. These services and processes are collectively called imaging and are the radio industry equivalent to what the motion picture industry would call special effects and stock footage to take the platform to a higher level. We're talking about jingles, special production music, interview and news clips, voiceovers, sounders, and all kinds of elements that help basic radio programming stand out and be special. In 2010, our guest launched Benstown Radio Networks, an international media syndication company providing dynamic programming, features, and services to radio stations and media companies around the world. With studios in Los Angeles, New York, and Stuttgart, Benstown offers the highest quality audio imaging work parts for 23 libraries across 14 music and spoken word formats. Benstown Radio Networks also produces, markets, and distributes high-quality programming and services to radio stations, including the Rick D's Weekly Top 40 Countdown, the Daily D Show, the Todd and Tyler Radio Empire, Hot Mix, Sunday Night Slow Jams with R-Dub, and a whole bunch more. Our guest is also executive producer of Benstown plus McVeigh Media Podcast Networks, establishing a major beachhead in the burgeoning podcasting industry. During the interview, our guest talks about his early days in San Diego and Los Angeles music radio as a producer and eventually a renowned program director. Our guest began his radio career in 1996 at KFMB in San Diego, earning acclaim as the producer and on-air sidekick for Michael Steele between 1996 and 1998, and later as the producer for Jagger and Christie between 1998 and 2000. After graduating from the University of San Diego with a degree in communications, he spent a year as Rick D's assistant producer at KISS FM in Los Angeles. In 2001, he joined LA's KBIG, KBIG, and Coast, K-O-S-T, FM, as operations manager, and in 2004, he was named program director for KBIG in LA, where he was extraordinarily successful. Although we covered a lot, we had so much fun talking about radio that we hardly scratched the surface of his amazing career. And because he was exceedingly generous and asked me about my life and career, I did a bit too much yakking about myself in this piece. Regardless, our guest this week is Dave Dennis, but everyone calls him Chachi. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Chachi. Dave Chachi Dennis, I got to tell you, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to take a chance that I might be the last person in the industry to know the answer to this. And I'm also going to take the chance that you might be annoyed by the question because it probably happens a lot. But where did you get the name Chachi?
Well, it's funny. I actually have two somewhat made-up names. My last name, Dennis, was actually made up by my grandfather. My real last name, or my family's real last name, I should say, was Davidovich. We were Hungarian Jews, and my grandfather changed the name during the war because of the persecution against the Jews. So it became Dennis, or Danish. But here in America, people say Dennis. And Chachi came from Tracy Johnson. I don't know if you know Tracy or not, but I got my start at KFMB Star 100.7 in San Diego, and this was in the mid to late 90s, back when Lilith Fair and artists like Alanis Morissette and Jewel were absolutely huge. And I got to work at this just incredible radio station there with Jeff and Jer and Jagger and Christie and amazing talent, Greg Sims. And I was producing a night show for Michael Steele, and Tracy wanted to give me a name that appealed to women. in their 30s, and because that was the demographic of the station, of course, a hot AC station, and women in their 30s in the 90s grew up watching Happy Days. And so that's where Chachi came from.
A great name. I mean, there's a warmth to it. And I certainly remember, you know, Chachi. And you're the only person I know whose name is Chachi outside of Chachi. And it stuck, huh? I mean,
it did. I got to meet Scott Baio once, and he actually signed a magazine cover for me that he was on. And he said, "I'm so sorry, Chachi. I'm sorry, Chachi."
Wow,
that's what the signature says.
I'm glad he didn't sign something that was suing you or something to that effect.
Yeah.
You never know.
No lawsuits, fortunately.
You were down in San Diego. I broadcasted in San Diego. Before we get you into San Diego, what kind of a kid were you, and where were you raised? Where did you grow up?
You know, I was raised in a small town called Hemet, which there's not a lot to Hemet. It was a retirement community at the time, and my father was a physician, and he was one of the first physicians in the area. And this was, you know, I grew up, I was born in 1975, and so I was there, you know, really up until the early 90s, or I should say the mid-90s when I moved away to school. And it was a pretty quiet community. It's about 100 miles east of Los Angeles. Now, tragically, and I'm sure you've heard about the tragic shooting in Monterey Park a few days ago. Mm. The shooter was from Hemet.
Oh, no.
And so it's gotten a lot of notoriety over the last few days in the news. But that's where I grew up and was there until I went to San Diego to go to the University of San Diego for school.
When I was in San Diego, it was a number of years earlier, though. I was there in the mid-70s. And if I knew then what I know now, I mean, I'm much smarter now than I was back then. I would have bought that $15,000.
I personally thought there was some great radio out of San Diego. You had, was it Rich Brother Robin was down there?
Oh, yeah, Rich Brother Robin, KCBQ. I competed with a little signal at 106.5 called KPRI, the original KPRI, which before it was a progressive rocker, it was Capri by the Sea. And my mission was to turn it from an underground hippy-dippy radio station that had no format at all and very low ratings into a station called AOR, Album Oriented Rock, which is a term I coined.
Sure.
So
Did you really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I coined the term Album Oriented Rock. I had come out of WNAW FM and WLIR on the East Coast, and they were pretty progressive stations. And the big issue then was, okay, what do we do with this so that we can keep it going into the future without just, you know, fading away into obscurity as we all try to play to each other and be more and more hip and more freeform and more obscure in terms of the music. And it was a big political thing as to, you know, do you do research? Do you play the hits? How many hits do you play? At what point are you selling out? To make a long story short, and again, I'm interviewing you, and you just asked me a very provocative question.
No, I'm so fascinated by that, because what an incredible claim to fame. I mean, to invent a format, not many people have done that. That's incredibly impressive.
It was so much my claim to fame in the early years of my career that Capitol Records actually made a gift for me, a gold piece of jewelry that you wear around your neck that said AOR. And
that's fantastic. Yeah, and, you got to send me a picture of it.
I found it the other day in, you know, one of those old dust boxes, you know, where you have old stuff. I went, oh, my gosh, I where'd this come from? But so I was doing album oriented rock, programming it at this little station. And I was up against one of the greatest top 40 program directors of all time, who was doing his own brand of commercialized album rock, Ron Jacobs, at KGB
sure.
AM and FM. And we battled for 2.5 years to a tie. I'd win a battle. He'd win a battle. You know, Arbitron, every point counted. I made a name for myself, and the rest is history. I went on to L.A. and various things. But I remember KCBQ had originally been influenced by Buzz Bennett. You may remember that name from those days.
Sure, Buzzy, I remember. I knew his name and never got to meet him, but I remember Mark Driscoll telling me all sorts of crazy stories about Buzz Bennett.
Yeah, great top 40 lore and history. So it was just a beautiful place to be. It was a radio paradise. And I spent 2.5 years there, and then I moved on to L.A. But
And incredibly competitive. What some people may not realize about San Diego is it's right on the border with Tijuana. So mm-hmm. you've got all the San Diego proper radio stations, plus several incredibly powerful sticks in Tijuana that obviously service the San Diego metro. And so you've got more, almost as many stations there as you do in Los Angeles, for instance.
Right.
So it's a very challenging market to program.
But just I was going to mention before that if I were smart then, I would have known to buy that $15,000 condo in La Jolla.
Yes.
And the radio station I worked at eventually sold for, I could have gotten it for $4 million. It sold for $40 million eventually.
Oh,
San Diego is one of the most desirable markets in the world. And all I thought about was how the hell do I get out of here and get back to L.A. or New York? And it was funny. Those were the days when you thought about the size of the market, you know, and we were young. You know, I was in my early to mid-20s in those days. So
I remember the late Charlie Tuna telling me a story that I believe, and I may be misquoting him, but I think he had the opportunity to buy K-Rock. And, you know, this is right at the advent of FM, but I think it was going to be like 1.8 or 1.9 million, and he could have owned K-Rock.
Mm-hmm. But you see, the problem is we were radio guys. We weren't business yeah. majors, and we did not know how to buy a radio station. We didn't know how to go out and get investors, how to take loans, how to raise money. We thought that you had to have $1.8 million and plunk it down.
And $1.8 million in the 70s was still a tremendous amount of money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everybody always thinks that the amount of money in the years that they are living, you know, in the now is a tremendous amount of money. Yeah, you know, it's
yes, true, true.
But you, one of the things that interests me about you, and frankly, for everybody listening to this, this is the first time you and I have spoken. We had a chat for about 3 minutes before we started to roll this thing, is that you came out of programming and, you know, production, obviously a kid that loved radio, and yet you've built this international business in an industry where it's very challenging to be successful, very challenging at this point. And you've built this tremendous business that is not just big here, but around the world, and all kinds of accolades. What is the key to making it in terms of business in the radio industry, without, you know, apologetic about radio, here in the 21st century? What's the secret to your success?
Look, man, that is so kind of you to say, and it really means a lot, especially coming from you. And as I'm learning more about you on this interview, I'm just really enamored by you. And I'm going to have to, by the way, return the favor and have you on my podcast, because I'd love to dig more into your career. I think that, you know, back to your question, the fundamentals have not changed. At the end of the day, we're in the entertainment business, and we're here to, I think, at least, create entertaining, compelling content that our listeners, you know, gravitate towards and want, you know, to escape with. And whether that is music programming or talk programming, sports, I think it's all actually very, very similar. People want to get away from their day and be able to relax a little bit or engage in something that's going to keep themselves to keep them entertained, and that's what we do. And so what we try, honestly, as far as Benstown goes, is to try to give our clients as many resources and tools as we possibly can to make their job a little bit easier, so they can ultimately go back and entertain their audiences. And I hope that kind of answers your question.
Basically, you're saying is do a good product and back it up with good service, and you'll do well. It's kind of an old-fashioned idea. So
in a lot of ways, I think it is. I've been very fortunate to, along the way, to have some amazing mentors like our friend Mike McVeigh, but Tracy Johnson and Johnny Kay and Michael Martin and Rick Dees. I've been so lucky, and so I've learned a lot from them. And so I think the way that we market the business has a lot to do with what I learned by someone like Tracy Johnson, who did these massive promotions in San Diego, like World to your hurl, the roller coaster. That ended up being such a big deal. It got national news, and they had some of the contestants. Jay Leno interviewed some of the contestants, and some of the more specific minutiae when it comes to making sure that we really don't miss any detail comes from what I learned from Johnny Kay, because Johnny was so detail-oriented and was all about the little things that you wouldn't even think about, building up the ramps and the tails of records and making sure that everything was enunciated properly. And so I've been able to take all these things that my mentors have taught me along the way, and I think coalesce it with a terrific team that I'm very blessed to have here, and we've been successful, knock on wood.
I'm not as involved in music radio today as I used to be. Obviously, I was immersed in it, and I evolved into talk. But it kind of is interesting to me, and a little bit encouraging, that if in fact there is still that attention to detail in music radio, that at least on your end, when you talk about ramps and going up and out and coming into a record, out of a record, all of these things that we used to be obsessed with, I say used to be because that's when I was in music radio, I guess it still exists to some degree. I get the feeling with music radio that it's just haphazard, that things are plunked into a continuum by a computer. And a lot of the things that we used to be concerned about, thinking of a radio continuum as being like a symphony, I don't hear it as much, but maybe I'm just not listening hard enough.
Yeah. I think you bring up some good points, and I believe there's probably some truth in both sides of it. There's no doubt in this day and age, and we all know all too well how busy everyone has become, and so a lot of programmers don't have the time and the attention, or I should say the time to pour the attention into the product that they used to. But I believe, I don't know if you've read Jeff Simoleon's book or not, but it's a terrific book, and he's got a quote, and I'm going to probably mess this up a little bit in there, but I believe that everyone really kind of shows up to work, and they want to do a great job. I think that whether they've got the time to do that now, when you're programming multiple stations, you've got multiple jobs, is questionable, but I think ultimately most people that gravitate towards this business want to have a great product on the air. And so, we do what we can to make their jobs, especially with our libraries and our imaging and some of our services, to make their job a little bit easier and to get them content that is going to really, I think, sonically speak to their listeners.
Yeah. Well said. You're right. I was just thinking about all the different things that you've got going there. You mentioned earlier Rick Dees. You're still involved with Rick Dees, aren't you?
We are. We produce, and really proud. We still produce his countdown show, and the weekly top 40. And Rick is doing well, and he still goes in to put the show together. And he spends about half his time here in L.A., and then the other half his time he's got a farm in Kentucky where he is a lot of the year as well.
Yeah, I think back to my days in L.A. I was the program director of KMET, which was
I didn't know that you, my God, man, your history is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. I couldn't keep a job or find a track that I could stay on. But Rick Dees.
And what was the really quick? KMET was all over. What was the movie?
Every movie, everything from FM to the one that just happened now. They just did a movie in L.A. because they had the KMET. Famous billboard,
yes.
where the logo was upside down,
yes.
which
oh
goes
gosh.
Back to the days of Shadow Stevens.
Of course.
And
oh my gosh.
Michael Hunter. Great.
Sorry, and I interrupted you, but no. I'm starstruck right now.
Don't be silly.
Amazing.
I was a small part of KMET for a very long time. I was an air personality there, same time that I was managing editor of Radio and Records. And I consulted them from behind the scenes because I was managing R&R. And I wanted to be involved in KMET. I loved the station. So I did a little DJ work there. And I started my talk radio career with a show called Harrison's Mic on the weekend. And I was one of the first youth-oriented FM news talk hosts. And it was on a rock station. I kind of modeled myself after a guy named Alex Bennett, who you may remember that name from New York. Was doing it on WMCA. So... But I was there a total of
about 10 and a half years. So I'm the longest running personality in the history of KMET. But I went
out. How much time did you spend up here in L.A.?
I was in L.A. Between R&R, between working at Billboard, redesigning their charts and being their editorial columnist in circa 1980, publishing a rock tip sheet called Good Phone, and being on KMET. I was in L.A. For about 14 years.
That's an amazing run,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, so I had a nice time in L.A., and I was in the syndication business. Again, we're turning this into about me. I hate to do that. I was one of the first.
Licorice pizza.
Licorice pizza. Yes.
With Bradley
well,
Cooper.
You know, you have no idea how many phone calls I got from people going, is KMET coming back? There's a billboard on Ventura Boulevard with the KMET logo. And I got to tell you, Chachi, it blows my mind that there is no KMET anymore. I can't imagine Los Angeles without it. And it's so many years ago that, what can I say? I mean, it's just, you know, the years go by. But Rick Dees, back to the Rick Dees question, he was gigantic when I was at KMET. He, you know, we would have like a 3 or 4 share, which for an AOR station was very good. He had like an 11 share. And there was one time that he was rolling along. I mean, I don't know if people realize how big Rick Dees was in his heyday. And the fact that he's still doing stuff and he still has syndication is indicative of his longevity. I mean, a brilliant broadcaster. But when he was in his heyday in his youth, he was dominant in Los Angeles on a level that was amazing. And then on top of it, he had a hit record called Disco Duck. Do you recall
that?
That's
right. Of course.
So, yeah. So the president
a number one record hit mm-hmm. record. I think it went to number one. I can't recall.
It definitely went to number one.
He's had a tremendous amount of success, and he still, you know, just loves the industry, loves the medium, and it's an honor and privilege to be able to produce his show. We get together, you know, once or twice a year to go golfing, and he is an incredible player. He still has no problem beating me around the course handedly, and he just, you know, still just loves doing what he does, and that's what I like about this business in so many ways. Is I've made, I guess, a family and so many friendships because I feel like we're just all bonded through this industry. In a lot of ways, it's almost like a high school. Even though we're all, you know, scattered around the country, it's still part of like this fraternity, which I think is just incredibly cool.
It's a fraternity and it's also a community. And I think that the community aspect of it really is a career builder. People that know how to operate and be good neighbors within that community. I certainly know a trade magazine, a trade publication has to build community to be successful. I think that,
sure.
You know, and those that are still doing it, my colleagues and friendly competitors are among the best that ever were, because this is the toughest time, I think, in the history of radio to play to that community spirit, because it's become extremely corporate and people don't have time. But the sense of community and fraternity, I think, is key to it. In other words, we used to call ourselves, and this is not meant to be gender oriented. It's just the way we called it. We were all radio guys, you know, hey, he's a radio guy.
Sure.
And, you know, it's nice that there are still radio guys. What do you think the biggest challenge facing radio is right now to continue on in, as we get deeper into this strange new world known as the 21st century?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple things. I mean, I think one is fragmentation, right? There's just so many different mediums that are vying for our attention. Mm-hmm. When we were coming up, you go back, you had newspapers and you had certainly television, but there was not social media or the internet or all these different things that were ultimately just available to people to consume. And so there's still only 24 hours in a day, yet there's infinitely more places that you can spend your time. And, you know, we've seen that across anyone that's in entertainment, and I think radio is actually holding up better than most through that. But there's just going to ultimately be, unfortunately, some audience erosion because there's just more things for people to choose and to spend their time consuming. So I think that's part of it. And I think the other part, or another key part, is that, you know, there's no doubt that the ownership rules and things like that changed, and certainly consolidation, you know, changed things and it became more corporatized. But I think the overall world is less patient. And I think that's across the board. I don't think that's just radio. I think that most, and maybe this is just a Wall Street thing in general, but most companies are all about, you know, now and what the next 90 days look like. There's not nearly the long-term thinking that there used to be. And I remember that story with Appetite for Destruction, and you'll probably know this story but much better than me. But I recall that that was out for like 18 months, and I think David Geffen had to call in a favor. Who was running MTV at that time? In the late 80s when that record came out. But whoever it was, David Geffen had to call in a favor to get the song played on MTV. And finally it started to get traction after that. But it took, you know, 18 months of them working that record, and it went on to be one of the best-selling records of all time. And I just don't think that the same type of long-term, I don't know if it's planning, but the long-term patience exists that used to exist. So you don't have time to develop shows. You don't have time to develop stations and formats like you probably would have, you know, a couple decades ago.
The record companies used to have, you know, artists and repertoire, A&R people, and they would sign an act and they would build it for maybe 2-3 albums and have patience for it. Now, you know, how much of a following do you have on Facebook? And if you have it, they'll sign you. Everybody wants an instant audience as opposed to building one. You're absolutely right. And even what you said earlier, there's no time to think. I think one of the biggest obstacles facing the creative arts today, you know, the commercial arts, is that people don't have time to hang out and talk and you know, brainstorm things. That's considered wasting time. What are you guys doing? Yeah. Well, we're thinking of a new way to develop the format. Get back to work. You know,
you're right. You're right. Yeah, you know, it's not quantitative, so therefore it's very difficult to put assess any sort of value to it. Mm. But you know, I think we're mostly artists in this business, and mm-hmm. you know, artists, it takes time. It takes time to develop great art. It takes time to develop a great brand. And the brands that I gravitate towards, and I think most of us do, have been around for a very long time. Very few brands are overnight sensations. You know, it took Apple how many years to become sometime I think it was in the early 80s. So we're 40 years past their inception for it to become the biggest, you know, company in the world. So we think that things are relatively new. Even Tesla, which has had a tremendous amount of success, that company is 11, 12 years old. It, you know, and that's really a very, very fast rise. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at stations now, and I don't mean to single out radio, but that's obviously the business we're in, but I just don't think companies have that type of, I don't know if gumption is the right word, but they won't stick by something long enough, in my opinion, to let it develop.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely, and it is the nature of the business cycle, and I've always believed the game is played the way the game is scored. And if you stop and think about that, people play to the way it's scored, whether it's how the ratings are done or how the books are kept and what the pressures are. Mm-hmm. And the game is played to the way the game is scored. And if the game is scored on a quarterly basis, you better get your points in by the end of the quarter and not say it's going to take 3 quarters. You know, the game is over, guys. Go home. Well, if we just have another 5 minutes, we'll score a touchdown. Nope. This is the way, you know, this is the way it is. So it's fascinating how fast things are going. I don't know if it's I don't know if it's the result of my age. You're younger than I am, but you've been around the block a bit.
Sure.
Do you think things are moving faster and faster? When you were talking about 10 years old Tesla, you ever find yourself saying, how long has that thing been going on? 12 years, 15 years? I still think of it as new. How's what's your perception of time?
It's so interesting. Tony Robbins says that most people overestimate what they can do in a year, but they underestimate what they can do in 10. Mm-hmm. And so I think that our perception is that, you know, a year is an incredibly long time. And in fact, it really isn't. A year is, you know, 365 days when you're building a product or you're building a show or whatever it is a really a short amount of time. You know, you get one shot at every season, right? And so my perception is, I think it was Bob Lawrence that told me, but his thought on it. But as we get older, time goes by faster because, and I'm not doing a good job of explaining this, but when you're, you know, 5, you know, each year is 20% of your life. Mm-hmm. But when you become 50, each year is only 2% of your life. And so, therefore, it goes quicker and quicker and quicker. And I always kind of thought that was an interesting perspective. But now it just, yeah, it really does blow my mind. We're 13 years old. We started in 2009. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, we're going to be 14 this year.
14 years. Remember when you were a kid, how long 14 years was? You know,
I keep a reminder in my calendar because I was let go when I was programming KBIG. I was let, or MyFM at the time, I was let go on Martin Luther King Day in 2009, and that reminder, and I keep a reminder just to kind of keep myself, I guess, grounded, or I don't know what it is, but I do it, and that just came up the other day, and it was 14 years ago.
Yeah, well, it's something that wiser men than us have been pondering for a long time, but I just find lately time has become even more difficult to grasp, and we are in a business that is so time sensitive, not just in terms of, you know, dealing with the clock, but dealing with eras, time, periods, yeah, history. Like, there's a big debate going on right now in the music radio world. Do listeners really give a damn what year the record was made? You know, because they're all... Am I right?
Which is an interesting, yeah, and that's an interesting point. I'm enamored by Disney. I look at Disney as just this phenomenal company, and they've done such a good job of evolving. That's a 100-year-old company now. Mm. But they've taken, look at what they've done with Marvel. Marvel, most of those characters are, you know, like the 50s and the 60s, and they've made those characters, and you think about that, right? Spider-Man, what is Spider-Man? 70 years old. But Spider-Man is just as relevant today, if not more so, than he was 70 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I find that really fascinating and an incredible art form. And so I wonder, the kid does not care, the consumer doesn't care that Spider-Man is 70 years old. It's that Spider-Man is in these really entertaining movies. And so, therefore, I'm a fan of Spider-Man.
And there you have it. An uninterrupted conversation with the head of the Benstown radio empire, Dave Chachi Dennis. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a co-presentation of Podcast One and Talkers Magazine, produced by Good Phone Communications. Copyright 2023, all rights reserved.